It is Thursday, June 8th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, former FBI Director James Comey testifies about his meeting with President Donald Trump. Islamic State threatens attacks against Iran. And singer Shakira returns to show business after taking time out for her family. It's all ahead. All eyes were turned towards Capitol Hill today as former FBI Director James Comey testified before the Senate Intelligence Committee. President Donald Trump fired Comey last month as an investigation was underway into possible connections between the Trump White House and Russian officials. Comey condemned Trump.
The administration then chose to defame me and, more importantly, the FBI by saying that the organization was in disarray, that it was poorly led, that the workforce had lost confidence in its leader. Those were lies, plain and simple. And I am so sorry that the FBI workforce had to hear them, and I'm so sorry that the American people were told them.
Comey was summoned to the White House for a one-on-one dinner with the president in January. Comey described the scene at the dinner.
The next Friday, I have dinner, and the president begins by wanting to talk about my job. And so I'm sitting there thinking, wait a minute, three times you've already asked me to stay or talked about me staying. My common sense, again, I could be wrong, but my common sense told me what's going on here is that he's looking to get something in exchange for granting my request to stay in the job.
I spoke with VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson and asked her about how Comey accused the president of lying about him.
That's right, Sarah. You've really pointed out one of the more stunning moments and really what has been an extraordinary day of testimony. That moment when former FBI Director James Comey said that the Trump administration's pushback after he was fired, implying or even straight out saying that the FBI had lost confidence in his leadership, were, quote, plain lies. That was really an extraordinary moment for a former FBI director to say and speak about the sitting president of the United States.
Now, Comey also talked about how he was invited to the White House in January and he had a one-on-one dinner with President Trump, in which he felt that he implied that the president wanted him to drop an investigation into possible connections between White House officials and Russian officials.
That's right, Sarah. And that was really the key question going into today's testimony. Everyone wanted to know from James Comey, did he feel that that movement, that action on the part of President Trump, was that an obstruction of justice? And the way Comey answered that was to say that that was a determination for Special Counsel Robert Mueller. That's under his purview to decide. But on Comey's part, he said that he himself felt deeply disturbed and very uneasy with that conversation with the president.
Now, apparently after his meetings, Mr. Comey talked about he took very careful notes. And I believe these notes he has since turned over to the special prosecutor as this investigation into this whole matter continues. But it sounds like, you know, Mr. Comey said he took notes. And meanwhile, President Trump has implied he might have even recorded this conversation.
That's right. And James Comey said that if there are tapes, then the president can go ahead and release them, that this will, if only, you know, help clarify this conversation that we have going on in the country right now. And, you know, one of the senators asked Comey why we should believe his word over President Trump's. I think that was a very interesting answer we got from James Comey. He said that he wanted people to look at the body of his testimony when weighing those factors and taking that decision into consideration. He has sometimes said things that have been complimentary of President Trump. He has always tried to be fair, honest, and balanced, and he asked people to consider the bulk of his work when making that decision.
How did his comments, how were they greeted by the senators, you know, from both parties? It seemed like, you know, they listened very carefully to what he had to say. I've not seen all the hearing, but it seemed from what I saw they accepted what he said. They didn't seem to be challenging him too much on his recollection.
Certainly, and one of the elements that goes into that is the amount of preparation I think we've seen from James Comey headed into today. You know, we not only have those memos, we also have the 7 pages of opening testimony that he released yesterday that gave everyone here in Washington a chance to really comb through what had happened and look at the details that Comey has pulled from those memos. He's also known as someone who prepares obsessively, who knows his details in and out. And I think that really helped him today in terms of his interactions with senators.
Now, I believe later today there will be another meeting between Mr. Comey and senators, but it will be behind closed doors.
That's right. And there are so many questions here about the broader issues of Russian election interference and some of the counterintelligence operations that go on in relation to that. That discussion, those issues have to be taken behind closed doors so that they can really hash some of those issues out.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Catherine.
You're so welcome.
That's VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson. And joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Pelshevsky. Well, Andrew, I can just imagine how this is being greeted on social media.
Where do we even begin, Sarah? We have hashtag Comey Day, hashtag Comey Hearings, James Comey, all trending, not just in the U.S., but worldwide. We're also seeing, as the different senators ask questions, their names are popping up and trending. So lots of social media coverage of this. One moment in particular getting a lot of attention is when James Comey talked about Russia and said this is not the only time we'll see Russian interference in our elections. So a lot of attention at these different little lines and sound bites that come through this testimony. But we're seeing a lot of social media interaction across the board. Bloomberg Television has partnered with Twitter to air the testimony live on Twitter. So you don't even need a television. You can watch it online.
Wow.
And one thing I think that many people were disappointed about is a lack of social media interaction from President Trump himself. There were rumors that he might be live tweeting during this testimony. There were reports that came out this morning that White House staff was trying to keep him busy so he wouldn't be able to tweet while this was going on. While President Trump has not tweeted, his son, Donald Trump Jr., has been tweeting, and people are looking to that, seeing a lot of pushback from him as this testimony is going on. Now, as Catherine just mentioned, there's a closed-door meeting that's going to go on. We're not going to be seeing that, obviously, on television. But there's some question as to whether information might leak out about that and whether it might show up on social media. So there's some interest in that as well. But across the board, lots of people talking about this. And not just in social media. At bars here in D.C. opened early this morning so people could go and watch the testimony. Perhaps only in D.C. could this possibly happen. But I know that there was one bar on social media that had a special every time Donald Trump tweeted, they would give a round of free drinks. Unfortunately for all the people that went to that bar, Donald Trump has not tweeted during this testimony, so no free drinks for anybody. But it's the only word I can think of is a spectacle, and it certainly has lived up to that in social media and here in D.C.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Pelshevsky. Here are some of the top news stories trending. The UN says the Islamic State has killed 231 civilians trying to flee Mosul. The U.S. job market gets stronger as layoffs decline. Heavy losses are reported as Somalia's Puntland forces repel an Al-Shabaab attack, and British voters cast ballots for the House of Commons. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Two teams of astronomers recently detected traces of methyl isocyanate, one of the chemical building blocks of life, within clouds of dust and gas surrounding several still-forming stars in a system nearly 430 light-years away. According to Niels Ligterink and Audrey Kootens, two of the researchers, methyl isocyanate is a member of a family of organic molecules that synthesize peptides and amino acids. These molecules, when they're in the form of proteins, are considered by scientists to be the biological basis for life as we know it. In 2012, scientists also found a simple form of sugar called glycolaldehyde in the cloud of gas and dust in this same protostar system. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, singer Shakira returns to show business. Iran's intelligence ministry said Thursday that five of the men involved in attacks on the country's parliament and the tomb of former leader Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini were Iranians who had joined the Islamic State group. The ministry said the men had fought for Islamic State in Mosul, Iraq, and in Raqqa, Syria, before returning to Iran in August of last year. Iranian officials also raised the death toll in Wednesday's attacks, saying at least 17 people were killed and 40 wounded. Iran Thursday denounced comments by President Trump, who said while the U.S. grieves and prays for the innocent victims of Wednesday's attacks, states that sponsored terrorism risk falling victim to the evil they promote. Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif in a tweet called the White House statement repugnant. He also said the Iranian people reject such U.S. claims of friendship. Iran blamed Saudi Arabia for being behind the attacks, which Riyadh denied. Indiana University's Hussein Banai tells International Edition's Victor Beatty there have been attacks targeting government institutions, especially during the Islamic Republic's first decade, but they were carried out by opposition parties trying to destabilize the regime.
But we haven't had an attack this symbolic against the parliament and at the shrine of the founder of the Islamic Republic by outside groups. And to have the kind of claim of responsibility be also broadcast over the internet so soon after the fact, it just seemed to, in fact, be a very spectacular exception to what has been for Iran a kind of a long peace since that first turbulent decade of the revolution.
Islamic State claimed responsibility. Could they conceivably have cells in Iran, of course, majority Shia country?
Yes. I think it's been long discussed by the Revolutionary Guards and Iran's intelligence agency that ISIS has cells inside Iran and that they're foiling these plots on a regular basis. But nowhere has the near kind of enjoyed this kind of a free reign as it does in obviously Iraq and Syria, where the central government is so much weaker. Iran historically has had a very strong central government, and it polices its borders well. And it was thought that the Revolutionary Guards actually did a fairly decent job of tracking Sunni fighters in and out of Iran. And so in that regard, this is an interesting and unexpected attack as well.
Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei said, quote, "These fireworks have no effect on Iran. They will soon be eliminated." Are you as confident as he is?
Time will tell. It's difficult to discern just what the message behind these twin attacks are. It's very clear that if you read the kind of boasting of ISIS about it, this has everything to do with revenge against Iran, support for Bashar al-Assad in Syria, but also of the growing influence of Iran among Shia populations in the Arab world. But it's unclear whether this is a one-off meant to kind of expose Iran's vulnerability, a message perhaps being sent by not just ISIS, but those who wish that attack like this would put Iran back in its place, put maybe perhaps public pressure on the Iranian government to scale back its activities in Syria, etc. Time will tell whether Iran will use this as a pretext for further entrenching its support for those groups, or whether, as the Supreme Leader suggested, is just a minor blip on the screen.
Hussein Banai of Indiana University said he fears these attacks prove Sunni-Shiite tensions are entering a new phase. A notorious warlord who recently signed a peace deal with Afghan President Ashraf Ghani has come to his defense. Ghani's own foreign minister has threatened to topple his government after security failures led to several attacks in Kabul. VOA's Aisha Tanzim has more.
Gulbuddin Hikmatyar, the warlord who reached a peace agreement with President Ashraf Ghani's administration, said he would not allow anyone to overthrow the government illegally. Efforts to do so, he said, would lead to Kabul being overrun by the Taliban. Those who are calling for regime change, we asked them, what alternative do they have? He asked. Hikmatyar added that without an alternative, the only result would be the fall of Kabul to armed insurgents. The Hizb-e-Islami leader was responding to warnings by Salahuddin Rabbani, Afghanistan's foreign minister, that the government must replace the heads of all of the country's security institutions, or his party, Jamiat-e-Islami, would move for a change in administration. Rabbani made the demand after a tanker bomb in one of Kabul's highly fortified areas killed more than 150 people. He also accused some in the security institutions of colluding with terrorists and trying to eliminate Jamiat-e-Islami's top leadership through what he called suspicious terrorist attacks. Rabbani was referring to an attack on a funeral last Saturday that was attended by Jamiat's leadership. Hikmatyar said no one could take power by force. The notorious warlord returned to Kabul last month for a red carpet reception by President Ghani. Hikmatyar's return was controversial, as many Afghans feel he should be tried for past war crimes. Feared as a ruthless warlord, Hikmatyar has been involved in much bloodshed during Afghanistan's decades of war. In the early 1990s, he attacked Kabul with rocket barrages that killed thousands of people. Ghani hopes a deal with Hikmatyar would encourage other militants to come forward and sign their own deals with the government. However, the Afghan Taliban have categorically rejected the Hikmatyar peace deal as un-Islamic and a surrender. Aisha Tanzeem, VOA News, Islamabad.
This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there. Bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world. And you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.
This is International Edition. Latin music star Shakira has a new album out, El Dorado. As VOA's David Byrd reports, the Colombian native used her own relationship with Spanish football star Gerard Piqué as her inspiration.
Shakira is probably best known in the English-speaking world for her smash breakout hit Hips Don't Lie from her seventh studio album Oral Fixation. The 40-year-old Colombian song for the 2010 World Cup football tournament, Waka Waka, became the most popular song ever to be associated with that event. The 2010 World Cup is also where she met her partner, Barcelona football star Gerard Piqué. On her new album, El Dorado, Shakira says she drew inspiration from her relationship with Piqué.
He looks at me with those eyes like, oh, you know, like really appreciating the fact that I almost paid an homage to that moment in our lives when we met each other and the turning point in our lives when everything changed for both of us.
Shakira says she felt it was time to return to work, after spending the past few years concentrating on her family and raising the couple's children.
I pressed pause on that, and now I hit play. I formed a family, and it's the most wonderful thing, the most important thing to me. And before I used to be the center of my whole world and the beginning and the end, the alpha and the omega of my whole world, and now my kids and my family are that one priority and the most important thing for me.
Getting back into the studio to record El Dorado proved more difficult than Shakira expected. But when she heard the song La Bicicleta, or The Bicycle, and learned that she could sing it with fellow Colombian musician Carlos Vives, Shakira says her creativity blossomed.
It opened up a whole world of possibilities, especially knowing that I could release my music on a song-by-song basis. It completely changed my game, and it incentivized me to make more music and not take this whole project as a whole body of work.
Shakira also shares the mic with another Colombian singer, Maluma, on the song Chantaje. Since its release last year, Chantaje has tallied more than 1.2 billion views on YouTube and 326 million plays on Spotify. Shakira also shares tracks with Prince Royce on Deja Vu, reggaeton singer Nicky Jam on Perro Fiel, and an English song with Nasri Atwe of Magic, What We Said. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
And that is our show for today. Please remember to visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
There has been a spike in violence in one of Africa's poorest and most war-torn countries, the Central African Republic, known as CAR. The United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs released a report this month saying that the frequency and brutality of attacks against communities have surged to levels last seen in 2014. Entire towns have been emptied, houses burnt down, and women and children brutally killed. The terrifying violence by armed militias in the CAR started in 2012 and intensified when a mostly Muslim rebel group, the Seleka, overthrew President François Bozizé in 2013. Atrocities committed by the Seleka gave rise to a predominantly Christian group to counter it, the Anti-Balaka, which similarly committed untold human rights abuses. Sectarian attacks by each group against each other and against innocent civilians devastated the country. An accord agreed to in 2015 by the rival militias requiring them to disarm, as well as a presidential election in 2016, raised hope for a new and more peaceful future for the country. But many armed rebels did not disarm, and violence has continued, and, as the UN has documented, recently escalated. The security situation in CAR deteriorated last month, leading to more than 300 people killed and over 100,000 displaced. In southeastern CAR, six peacekeepers from MINUSCA, the UN peacekeeping mission in CAR, were killed near the town of Bangassou. In the central town of Bria, violence between rebel groups resulted in thousands of civilians pouring into makeshift camps. The United States is deeply concerned by the recent violence. In a written statement, State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert said, "We strongly condemn these acts of violence and the targeted attacks against humanitarian actors, whose sole purpose in the CAR is to provide life-saving support to the population." Spokesperson Nauert wrote that the United States mourns the deaths of the UN peacekeepers as well. The security and support provided by MINUSCA are essential for the CAR to move beyond crisis, she noted.
"We commend President Faustin Archange Touadéra and his government for their commitment to justice, the rule of law, and accountability for perpetrators of mass atrocities, including through the creation of the Special Criminal Court," said Ms. Nauert. "The United States fully supports justice and reconciliation, not only as measures for individuals who have suffered, but as essential steps towards building a peaceful and inclusive CAR."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.